what worries me about China is they've done such a great job. It's paradoxical, but they've done such a good job with the electricity and the water and the other infrastructure that they've built an economy that wastes enormous resources. Electricity is just part of it. Electricity, you know, it goes off, it's a problem. You lose your water and you're really in trouble. I think there's some kind of hard stop issues that the Chinese haven't really faced up to.
That was the voice of Mark Clifford, a former contributor to Fear, the legendary Far Eastern Economic Review, and now executive director of the Asia Business Council. He's also the author of the essential and important book, The Greening of Asia. It's a timely subject made all the more important in the wake of the U.S. decision to withdraw from the Paris Climate Change Agreement. Trump's disdain for the environment and dismissal of scientific evidence pointing to global warming is a subject unto itself, but the broader question speaks to the political vacuum left in its wake. Given that it's not going to be the U.S., which nation will assume the required leadership role to get us out of this global environmental mess that we humans have created? All eyes are now on China. If there's anyone who can look into the seas of time, it's Mark Clifford. I started off by asking him what brought him to Asia.
I was doing a fellowship at Columbia University in New York for journalists who specialize in business and finance, and I'd quit my job at Forbes magazine in New York to do this fellowship, and I'd never been to Asia except for Turkey, and I was very interested in economic growth, economic development, and the Four Tigers have been rocking and rolling. This was 1986, and Asia was booming. I applied for a job to the Far Eastern Economic Review, which was based in Hong Kong, and a guy named Philip Bowring and Derek Davies were nice enough to offer me a job in Korea. They basically hired me sight unseen. I basically thought that I'd missed all the excitement in Asia. This was 1987, the spring by the time I arrived, and Japan and the Four Tigers, Taiwan, Korea, Hong Kong, Singapore had been booming for 20 years, 30 years in the case of Japan. And we knew that China was changing. And you could take a piece of graph paper or a pencil and start penciling out what 6% or 8% growth might mean in a place like China if it went on the way it had in those other East Asian countries.
And there'd been about 6 years after Deng Xiaoping came to power, and he was talking about opening up the market. So even though there was political issues, economically, he was saying it's time for us to liberate.
Right, exactly. And this had been going on, and people have been talking about it a lot. And I remember China had just floated its first international bond since before 1911, since the Qing Dynasty. At this point in the 1980s, bondholders were still trying to get their money back from the railway bonds of the old Qing Dynasty. So the fact that China was even the communist sort of post-Maoist China was preparing to rejoin the capitalist world and was going to go to the bond market, that was phenomenal. And we're talking about tiny amounts of money, around $100 million or something. Tiny compared to the amounts we're talking about now. So,
but nobody really took it seriously at that point either, right? They were still looking at the Four Tigers, thinking that's what the growth, and hoping that Japan would kind of come back and have another economic surge.
Right. Well, this was actually during the 80s, right after the Plaza Currency Accord. And so Japan was booming. This was the sort of, as it turns out, the peak of the boom for Japan. People were hoping for China, but it was a bit like that old 19th century thing. Every Lancashire cotton mill hoped that the Chinese t-shirts could be an inch longer and they'd get rich. It was that kind of thing. Nobody was really in China. A foreigner who went there couldn't use Chinese currency. You could only go to the so-called friendship stores using your foreign exchange certificates to buy some Hershey's chocolates or some Chinese linen. And the Chinese couldn't go to those stores. So,
but there was the back alleys and those who would trade with you. I remember that.
Yeah, there was. But it was a very, very closed place. As a journalist, you needed special visas. You had to hire a minder. So I arrived in Asia in May 1987. I arrived, went up to Korea on June 2nd. And
why Korea, Mark?
That's where the Far Eastern Economic Review sent me.
Had no background or experience whatsoever, didn't speak Korean, anything.
I'd never been to Asia except for those 2 months in Turkey in the summer of 1986.
You must have had something on Philip Bowring to let him, to convince him that I'm the guy.
I think Asia, there was so little Asian expertise at that point, and I didn't have any Asian expertise. What I had was 6 years working in the financial and business press in New York, and that was in short supply in Asia. And again, Asia was just starting to open up, and it didn't seem that brave to just get on a plane and come out here. But in fact, not that many people did it at that point.
And what did you discover when you landed in Seoul?
Well, it was quite a tense time politically. Chun Doo-hwan was still the dictator. He was president, but his picture was above the fold on the front page of every newspaper every day. There were only a handful of newspapers, all government licensed, restricted as to the number of pages that they could print, and they all had Chun's picture on the top of the page every single day. Kim Dae-jung, who later became president, was under house arrest. Kim Yong-sam, who also became president later, was under a lot of pressure. There'd be little articles about him in the back of the paper, no photos. And 8 days later, some demonstrations started. And by the end of the month, the government had caved and Korea was on its way to free, fair, open elections and on the way to that whole democratization process that they've been going through.
And you were there.
It happened 8 days. Started 8 days after I came.
And you could not have timed that better.
And when I got there, everyone said, oh, yeah, there's a demonstration. It's not going to amount to anything.
And then how long did you stay in Korea?
I was in Korea for 5 years, saw the Olympics, saw obviously the whole wave of democratization, a whole wave of 12-13% economic growth, and really saw Korea go from a very hard authoritarian place and a very closed place. Koreans could not get passports to travel abroad unless they had a business reason and it was a one-off passport. And there were very few foreign visitors there other than the U.S. military. And by the time I left, they were Korea was almost a pariah state, because we forget that North Korean and South Korean economies were not that different at that point. The South had only surpassed the North a little over 10 in the early to mid 1970s. And so there was still this, we didn't know who was going to win the battle for Korea at that point. And we didn't really know which Korea was going to come out on top. It wasn't as obvious just what a pathetic model the North was pursuing. And the North had the diplomatic relations with China, with Russia, with what was then called the Warsaw Pact, the whole Soviet bloc. We forget, this was before 1989. There was a Berlin Wall, there was a Soviet bloc, there was a Soviet Union. And South Korea was really cut off. The Olympics allowed it to start breaking that diplomatic ice, but they didn't have relations with China until 1993. China's now their largest trading partner.
It's such a reminder, isn't it, Mark, on how quickly this has all developed. I mean, these countries have come up from nothing. I mean, they've now are world powers in the areas of economics. And, you know, when you and I first arrived, there was just nothing there. There was rice paddies and, you know, the ideas of a democratic system or at least a capitalist system. And, you know, now here we are looking at this and it's the powerhouse in the world.
It's remarkable. I feel very lucky. As I said at the beginning, I thought that I was a little late to the party. But in fact, it was just beginning. And it was just beginning because it was still such early days for China, and India had not even started its reform process. And even the most optimistic people on China, even the ones that thought that they could become rich off China or thought that China could do something on the order of what the East Asian countries have done, even those people were not optimistic enough. And what you and I have seen in China and in these other countries is one of the greatest creations of wealth, but more than just wealth, of human development that the world has ever seen. And development's not BMWs and apartment buildings. It's being able to send your daughter to school. It's being able to take your son to the doctor to get some and be able to afford the antibiotics that he needs. And that's what we've seen for hundreds and hundreds of millions of people, above all in China, that's pulled somewhere like 600 million people out of absolute poverty.
But development also has its dark side. On behalf of the 77 members of the prestigious Asia Business Council, Mark and his team explore key themes essential to Asia's growth and prosperity. One of those themes is the environment and the role that Asia plays in both destroying and protecting it. I asked him to talk about his book, The Greening of Asia, his findings, and his take on Asia's environmental future.
In Asia, there's been a strategy, I think, among the fast-growing Asian economies of get dirty, get rich, get clean. And whether you look at Japan or you look at the Four Tigers, they were incredibly noxious polluters. We can just go through almost every country. There's been one form of environmental disaster or another. And they thought that they couldn't afford to be green, to be clean. As they got richer and there was more public pressure on them, they realized they had no choice but to get clean. And I've always written about environmental issues and been interested in them. And when I joined the Asia Business Council, my predecessor, Ruth Shapiro, who was the founder, had launched an almost almost finished a study on green buildings in Asia. And we forget how quickly things changed. This was 2007, and green buildings were still a pretty exotic concept. And
These are environmentally controlled, environmentally optimized buildings using certain materials, just so if in case people aren't sure with this, in order to reduce and make them more efficient. Is that right?
Yeah, a green building uses less energy. Okay. It tries to make sure that you're just as comfortable, you're just as cool, the light's just as good, and you're just as comfortable as you'd be, but you're using a lot less electricity or a lot less power. And so we did more work on this and ended up doing a book on it. And it was, I think, the first book of its sort that was really looking at it from a Pan-Asian perspective. And I was interested in talking to members and other people how much was going on. And I was actually quite surprised because as a journalist, this was an area that I paid a fair amount of attention to. And what struck me is that the business sector is actually doing much more than people realized, and certainly much more than it was being given credit for. Certain companies were leading companies where I don't mean that every business is virtuous, quite the contrary. But I'm fortunate that many of the members who've joined the Asia Business Council are pretty forward-looking, visionary people. That's why they spend the time.
Beyond green buildings, you're talking about environmental planning, or whether it's palm plantations, or any sort, or investment in solar, wind, whatnot.
Yeah, I should back up and say absolutely. I first focused on green buildings because that's what the book was on, and I was stunned to find that some of the most advanced buildings in the world and some of the most cutting edge work was being done here in Asia. Because we think of Asian companies as being laggards, as being copycats, as always playing catch up with things that are going on in the West. And in fact, in Japan, even in India, one of our members, Jamshed Godridge, is the father of green buildings in India. And back in 2003, had built a building that the U.S. Green Building Council, which is sort of, you know, the organization globally to look at these things, called the most energy efficient building of its type anywhere in the world. And I was stunned when I joined the council. And actually, I coincidentally met Jamshed my first week with the council to find out this was going on. Because, again, I'm a journalist. I write about these issues. I follow these issues. And I knew nothing about it.
So there is an Asian consciousness about this. I mean, oftentimes the press gets on to Asia, the world's greatest polluter. Well, that's only recently. I mean, the U.S. has been the world's largest polluter for decades.
Asia is the world's largest polluter. Part of the fact is it's got 4 billion people here or so. So it's got more people than any other continent. But I've been fortunate in many of the people who are in the Asia Business Council are running family-owned companies. Some of their companies are over 100 years old. You don't run a 100-year-old family company and have it still in the family if you're not running a sustainable business. And sustainability, I usually focus on the environmental side, but sustainability means your relations with your employees, your relations with your community. And it means not just dumping a lot of toxic trash out into the community. Otherwise, you're going to lose your social license to operate. And so, again, I've been lucky that I'm working with a lot of people of a longer term vision. And what they've done and what I really learned is they've looked at the hard economics of looking for business opportunities in clean tech of one form or another. So green buildings, turns out they don't really cost much more to build than a regular building. But if you own the building, the savings that you get on the light and the air conditioning pay back very quickly, within a couple of years, usually 7 years at the max.
Well, it took a while for people to get their heads around that, the idea that efficiency actually is good business. And therefore, if you can think longer term and build capable buildings, or you can deploy solar or wind to support your businesses or industries, it's actually a good thing. It just may not pay back immediately.
Absolutely. And again, I think we're looking for the business case for environmental sustainability. If you just look at it on a moral basis, great. You can have NGOs and they can put pressure on companies and on governments, and things do happen. But if there's not an economic underpinning for it, it's really not going to be that effective. And one of the most heartening things in the last decade has been the degree to which solar and wind prices have fallen so dramatically that renewables are now competitive with coal and with other fuels.
You know, and a lot of people don't realize, but we need to give credit to China. Maybe not for all the right reasons, but the reason that you can now deploy solar farms and you can deploy it in an industrial scale is because Chinese manufacturers drove the price of solar panels down, whether right or wrong, and we're going to talk about that in a minute, to the point where it became actually more economically viable.
Absolutely. China did with solar what we've seen them do with so many other industries. In this case, it's worth taking a few minutes to talk about exactly what happened. Germany and a couple of other European countries, but especially Germany, had an energy transition policy, the Energiewende, to move away from coal, and they subsidized solar quite heavily. This was in the mid-2000s, around 2005, or starting around the turn of the century. And some Chinese manufacturers, led by a company called SunTech and a guy called Xu Zhengrong, saw that this was a business opportunity that was too good to miss. He saw that his competitors, European, Japanese, Americans, were selling solar panels at a pretty high price. And the way the subsidies worked in Germany, where whoever installed solar was going to get a very high price, a high tariff rate for their electricity, even though the solar panels were more expensive, they had to buy those solar panels. The panels were expensive. And Xu Zhengrong and some other Chinese companies did what the Chinese do so well. They said, we can sell it 5% cheaper, 10% cheaper, 20% cheaper. And they came in and they destroyed that market as a profitable market. And they competed with each other. And people forget about this. The Chinese are ruthless competitors. If you're a foreign company, I think they may be even more ruthless towards each other. And they just drove the prices down to the point that solar prices have fallen well over 90% in the last 10 years.
And there was a lot of controversy around that because the feeling was they were dumping on the market. In fact, there was some government, at least some government-backed banks that were helping finance this development to get the economies of scale in order to drive down the per unit cost. Can you tell us a little bit about systematically what was happening in China?
You're absolutely right, Steve. What happened was that solar became an industry that the government decided it wanted to support. And so it was a combination of national support and local support. And in the case of Xu Zhengrong, because SunTech was a public company, we could actually see the scale of the subsidies that they were getting. They were quite significant, and they came in the form of very inexpensive land rentals and industrial parks in the form of access to significant bank loans, which meant that they could expand very quickly. The loans were at, they were not at high rates. I don't want to say they were at cheap rates, but they were at very reasonable rates. But just the access to credit in China means that you can expand. There were also subsidies for research and development. There were subsidies throughout the whole chain, the entire ecosystem of China, from the banks to the officials to everybody, particularly in localities where companies like SunTech employed significant numbers of people, were all driving to support these companies. And this was going on at over 400 solar companies in China. So every town, every city of a million people, and even a few more, needed to have its own solar manufacturer. And most of these, of course, were not economic. But
so you could see it coming. I mean, you could just, the bubble was going to burst on this one.
What happened was SunTech got into a situation. And my principal researcher on the book, a woman named Jill Baker, who's a certified financial analyst, really dug into these numbers. And we could see the crash before it was coming, because what was happening is they were taking on more and more debt. The interest payments alone were starting to engulf them. So they needed to grow the top line more and more. And eventually, the whole thing collapsed. There were some potential fraud issues and there were some shenanigans. But even without the questionable practices, it was going to come to an end. And that's absent anything else. Xu Zhengrong made a very, very big bet on silicon wafer prices, and he bet the wrong way. He thought that they were at a couple hundred dollars a kilogram. They eventually peaked at $500 a kilogram. He had a lot of contracts which obligated him to pay, to called take or pay contracts. He had to take the silicon at a certain price. Unfortunately, they went from $500 a kilogram to $17 a kilogram as a lot of Chinese capacity came on. So it's the old story. I mean, it's horrible if you're a shareholder in one of these companies. And we've just seen company after company go bust. But the net effect of it is the rest of the world is just laughing, because if you're in a village in Africa, or we might talk more about India later on, I mean, solar is all of a sudden the cheapest thing around. You've got to reconfigure your thinking. Utilities have to rethink about how they're going to distribute electricity. The whole utility model of the last 100 years is getting smashed. But the Chinese did us all a great favor by doing that.
This is Steve Stein, and you're listening to Inside Asia. It's the Greening of Asia episode, and my guest is Mark Clifford, Executive Director of the Asia Business Council and author of The Greening of Asia. Let's get back to our conversation. I just asked Mark if he thinks China is ready to step up to a leadership position globally when it comes to environmental protection, particularly at a time when it's struggling to manage clean air and water at home.
That's a great question, and let me answer it in several different ways. First, for all the harm that the Chinese have done to competing solar manufacturers, it's been great in terms of creating jobs. In America and Europe, the jobs are really for the people who are putting the solar panels up and for the people that are using them. So sure, if you're a solar manufacturer, I don't want to minimize the impact that the Chinese have had or to say that they've played by all the WTO and other rules. I just, you know, I'm not going to make a comment on that. But I would remind people that most of the money in putting a solar installation in right now is not in buying the panels. It's in hiring your contractor to put the panels on your house, or if you're a utility, it's building the solar farm and then running it. So there are a lot of jobs out there that are being created. There are many, many more people in the solar industry in the U.S., U.S. solar jobs, than there are U.S. coal jobs right now. So Trump talks about bringing coal back, but actually what he should really do is keep putting the foot on the accelerator for solar and also for wind. Texas, of all places, you know, center of the oil industry, is one of the biggest wind producers in the world.
Well,
right,
that would, that would require Trump to look at the numbers and the figures, and we don't, you know, he doesn't want to do that, right?
Fortunately, in the case of China, we have a country that's run by scientists and engineers and people who really have a fact-based reality. And I think that your question about Chinese leadership is interesting. I think that we will see leadership in terms of corporate leadership and industry leadership in areas like solar, wind. We haven't talked about batteries, but I think that transportation and batteries and storage are really the next big thing. Because if we can get the battery situation and the storage situation to a point where it's cost effective to have a solar system that's not connected to the grid, or it's cost effective to really have an EV, an electric car, then where it's a whole different ball game. And I think the Chinese are working very, very hard on that. So I think we're going to continue to have a lot of technical innovation in China. I think there is technological innovation. I don't think it's as leading edge as the U.S. and some European or Japanese companies. But don't count the Chinese out. I mean, these are really well-trained, well-educated people. Their universities are good, but more to the point, they have hundreds of thousands of people who've studied in the States and then come back. The question is their system open to the kind of research innovation that the U.S. system is? It's not there yet, but don't just count them out and think they're just condemned to be copycats forever.
This is where policy, investment, and the will to change are all converging, it appears. And if you look at the numbers or forecast numbers on China's investment in clean tech between now and 2030, it's really off the charts. It outpaces the U.S. 7-1, many parts of the rest of the world 10-20-1. They really are serious. But explain to us why. There's a couple reasons why they're so serious.
Well, I think the first reason is the one that you said. They see it as an industrial revolution. They like to be part of industrial revolutions. They are looking for ways that their manufacturers can move up the value chain. They see this as one of the industries of the future. They see manufacturing as remaining a backbone of their economy in a way perhaps the same, similar to what the Japanese or the Germans think. The U.S., Trump and others notwithstanding, the manufacturing sector is a pretty small part of the U.S. economy. I think the Chinese, like the Japanese and maybe the Koreans, they don't see things like services in the creative economy. They don't really see them as serious. They see manufacturing as something serious. It's a country run by scientists and engineers, and they like to make things. So that's number one. The other thing is China, like its Asian neighbors and the Four Tigers and Japan, thought that it could pursue a get dirty, get rich, get clean strategy. But it's having to accelerate that, and it's having to get clean a lot earlier than it thought it would. It has a population that isn't that interested in sustainability as some kind of, you know, groovy thing, but they're interested in sustainability when it's like the air that their kids, sorry, their one child is breathing, because pretty much everybody's got one child. They don't really like it when they can't see across the street because the air pollution's so bad. They don't like it when it turns out the food is being poisoned by melamine or some other plastic or other toxins. And so the public pushback, the public desire for health, especially for their children, but for everybody, is becoming a political force that China simply can't ignore. When you have in the Capitol people attacking the party secretary or the mayor, as prominent journalists did recently because of air pollution, that's something that even the Communist Party, even the almighty, all-powerful Communist Party cannot ignore, because we forget that the Communist Party is actually incredibly responsive to popular discontent. They spend huge amounts of time putting down the 100,000 or so large-scale demonstrations that they deal with every year. Think of that. Yeah. 100,000 demonstrations a year. That's like 300 and something a day.
It's amazing, right? And it's and they were born of this idea of revolt. So, you know, they know political instability could mean something more, and it can move like wildfire. And so I hear you on this, and I do think they're starting to be responsive to it, maybe a little bit late, because there was this conflict of, well, we have to develop, we have to grow, we have to make sure people have jobs and incomes and savings rates, get savings rates up. And now it's pushing into the second tier cities, and they didn't want to compromise or slow that down. At the same time, they're paying a price for it.
I think there's still this tug of war going on. I think they've been talking green for exactly a decade. It was exactly 10 years ago in the middle of 2007 when Hu Jintao started talking about climate change, carbon, air pollution. And now it's a mainstream discourse. But in some ways, we can talk about the ways they've made a lot of progress in the last 10 years, especially the last couple of years. But we can't forget the fact that there are a lot of local officials whose number one priority is jobs. And they see shutting down that horribly dirty cement plant that produces all this cement that nobody even wants at a huge environmental cost and an economic loss. They see shutting down those plants as anathema. They don't see how they can do it. They'd probably be better off just paying people to stay at home, but it's tough to do that. So at a local level, there's still a lot of people who haven't gotten the message. I think at the top level, they know the theory. I should also say that it's cheaper in China, and it has been for some time, to build an energy efficient building than it is to build the coal-fired power plant and the electricity, the distribution lines to heat and cool and light that building. Forget about the pollution, forget about the carbon, forget about the climate change. It's actually cheaper. And yet China, because of its, I think, quite distorted political system, hasn't managed to do that. It's so top down that it has no kind of bottom up drive for people, for builders and other people, to do the right thing, even though it makes economic sense.
And isn't that the thing with China, pushing it down from through the, you know, from the federal down to the municipal, down to the, you know, the local level, right into the communities, is a very difficult thing to do. They've got, the manpower and the bureaucracy, but then making sure everyone's incentives are aligned and people are prepared to follow through takes time.
I think India is an extremely interesting example to look at by contrast. In China, electricity prices are underpriced or very low, particularly for industry, because the government wants to help industry. In India, electricity prices are very high. They're market prices, and often you can't get electricity. So the buildings are run really efficiently. Water, the same thing. In China, there's lots of water. The infrastructure is good. They may be tapping the aquifers. It may be completely unsustainable. Beijing, in fact, is in a very arid part of the country that gets about as much water as Saudi Arabia does in an average year. And those aquifers are going down, but they're using it as if it's a completely sustainable resource. At some point, they're going to run out of water, and then they're going to have a serious, serious problem. In India, because water is in short supply and it's hard to get clean water, they've done a much, much better job of managing with very limited resources. What worries me about China is they've done such a great job. It's paradoxical, but they've done such a good job with the electricity and the water and the other infrastructure that they've built an economy that wastes enormous resources. Electricity is just part of it. Electricity, you know, it goes off, it's a problem. You lose your water and you're really in trouble. I think there's some kind of hard stop issues that the Chinese haven't really faced up to.
Yeah, I mean, we're looking at this conundrum in Asia where, you know, they're there's the need to care for your people, to meet expectations. There's the political establishment that doesn't want to lose power. There's fledgling democracies that are banking on their ability to deliver on these things. And yet the pollution and the environmental disasters and the issues keep growing. Recently, the Bloomberg New Energy Finance, we came out with a report talking about 150 million metric tons of plastic floating in our oceans, and have determined from their research that 86% of that comes out of Asia. 86% between Indonesia and China is the two primary culprits through all those waterways down into the ocean. So at the one hand, they are, you know, perpetuating the problem, but then they have to deal with it in some way. And this is the bind they're in right now. What do you think is going to evolve, or how are they going to address this, and which market is going to take the leadership role in that?
Those are great questions. The plastics number is so shocking and so discouraging because, for the most part, I think it's unnecessary. It's people who just are just throwing stuff into their waterways. And we've seen this. I mean, unfortunately, there's a kind of culture of, you know, you throw it out in front of your house. I mean, not in a place like Hong Kong, but in China and a lot of other countries, there's a kind of thing of just throw it away and it'll get washed away or something, and there it goes. And I don't know how you got to change that public perception too.
Yeah. Do you remember that advertisement during the late 1970s where the Native American on the side of the highway, and somebody throws a bag of French fries at his feet, and the tear coming down his face? And it turned the tide on American sentiment around caring and loving our environment. And it was a major national campaign to turn. Do you think that a place like China does enough in that space in terms of awareness and raising awareness among its people? And should it and could it do more?
I can just say that Hong Kong used to be a pretty filthy place, and Singapore used to be, if you believe Lee Kuan Yew's memoirs, unbelievably dirty. And both of these places have, as a result of these sorts of campaigns and strong and consistent pressure that comes from the top and from the bottom, become some of the cleanest places in the world. So I have to believe it can happen. When I lived in Korea in the late 1980s, early 1990s, I remember seeing factories that would have effluent that looked like it was espresso coming out just right into waterways. You don't see things like that anymore in Korea or in Taiwan. So in Japan used to be, you know, you'd be spraying pesticide like right, left and center, and that was what you did. And now in places like Korea and Japan, organic food is hugely in demand. So I think that as people get wealthier, they put more pressure on their governments, but it has to come from both ways. You do need these sorts of public campaigns. And you know, China has such big problems, and I just don't think its leaders see these issues, even though they have a global impact, as ones that they should really focus on. And unfortunately, in Indonesia, the government doesn't even have the kind of strong state capacity that a Chinese government has.
Right. Mark, do you find any irony in the fact that since we've been talking about these issues, the temperature in this office has gone up from 100 to about 110, 12? I feel climate change is very apparent to me. Is it to you?
I think you must not be used to Hong Kong, or else that black shirt is like too hot, because I feel quite comfortable. But I think this is a very important message, and that's that climate change is here. 10 years ago, you could say, oh, it's my grandchildren. 5 years ago, you might say, it's my children. Now we see the reefs are being bleached. The coral fish are being gobbled up by people in unsustainable fisheries. The sea level is rising. Places like, well, Bangladesh had a storm that killed 140,000 people.
It's unbelievable, right? And we barely hear about this.
Yeah. And so the sea levels are rising. And in rich countries, the Netherlands has been a leader in this. You can deal with it. You can basically build a moat around your country. Mm-hmm. That seems in some senses to be the U.S. policy, but U.S. has a pretty big shoreline to build around. It's not going to be quite as easy as it was in the Netherlands. And I think the irony is that it used to be that Asian people, Asian governments said, we can't afford to clean up. And now increasingly they're saying, we can't afford not to clean up. We have to clean up. And it's our health. It's our long-term well-being of our cities. You look at the number of people who live along the oceans in Asia. I mean, all the big cities, Shanghai, Hong Kong, Tokyo, Jakarta, Singapore, Manila, are in Bangkok, famously, are in low-lying areas. When we met in Jakarta a few years ago, we needed to make sure that our meeting was not going to take place during a full moon because it was much more likely as a tidal surge, which puts parts of Jakarta underwater. And you see these pictures of people leaving the Four Seasons hotels floating out in little plastic laundry buckets because even a place like the Four Seasons is not protected. I think there's a notion, particularly among better off, more affluent people, maybe Americans in general, maybe affluent people in general, that somehow they can buy their way out of this. But as we saw with Fukushima, as we saw with the tsunami, as we see with big storms, when you're in the way of Mother Nature, you can't do anything, whether it's an earthquake or a tsunami or whatever. And I think that people sometimes forget there are much bigger forces and they're much closer to causing really big damage. I don't want to sound apocalyptic because we don't actually know. We don't know what the impact of the Arctic and Antarctic ice sheets melting is. We don't. And that's that. I think the climate deniers or the skeptics will say, well, you don't know. I say, of course we don't know. But you buy an insurance policy. You don't know. That's why you buy an insurance policy. And the insurance policy now, thanks in large part to the Chinese, has the premium on that insurance policy has plummeted in the last 10 years. So to start reconfiguring your energy and environmental systems, which takes decades and trillions of dollars, but you got to start somewhere and you have to start doing it because the real moment is coming a lot closer.
Well, and you raised a really good point. Immediacy can be a great motivator. Like you say, if we're living with it and we see examples of it all around us, even in rich and wealthy cities, and people start to say, oh my God, it's here, it's arrived.
I think this is where we get back to China. China's a big country which has very severe and erratic weather. And somewhere in China is usually suffering from too little rain, and somewhere else is suffering from too much rain, usually at the same time. But this is a country that throughout history has had to deal with enormous climactic variations, and dynasties have risen and fallen because of weather, because of famines, because of floods, because of droughts. And I think that people who don't think that China's serious about climate change and about environmental spending are just kidding themselves. They don't understand Chinese history. They don't understand the very strong desire on the part of the Chinese leadership and its Communist Party leadership to stay in power. And that means in some sort of Confucian communist sense, taking care of people. And that means protecting them. And that's what the emperor, that's what the leader is supposed to do. And if you mess it up, you've lost the mandate of heaven. Now, that sounds like a cliche, and in some ways it is. But I think it's this kind of thinking that's really driving a lot of what the leadership's thinking. And they have done a tremendous job of pulling people out of poverty, of promoting economic growth. But they now realize they cannot afford to ignore the environment.
Mark, that's a more hopeful note to end on. And I thank you very much for your time. And thank you for the work and the contribution you've made to this area. I look forward to speaking to you in cooler climates.
Thanks so much for coming over. It's a real pleasure talking to you. I love these podcasts, and I'm delighted that you're trying to give listeners a sense of what's really going on the ground here in Asia. It's exciting. We've got more than 4 billion people here trying to eke out a living and trying to survive at this time of climate change.
Thank you, Mark.
It's a real pleasure. Thank you. It is getting hotter in here.
I'm Steve Stein, and this is Inside Asia. That was my interview with Mark Clifford, who, among other things, is an environmental protection advocate and the author of The Greening of Asia. As my listeners know, I like to end each episode with a bungkus, which in Indonesia is a wrapped takeaway bundle of deliciously prepared fried rice. I don't know if there's a way to deliciously bundle impending environmental catastrophe, but then again, I don't know if it's the end of the world as we know it. There's no disputing the science of environmental change. We can already see how the world has been and will continue to be altered because of it. Like it or not, climate change will affect us all. Economies undermined, businesses demolished, communities underwater, and lives lost. We brought this on ourselves. The question now is, what can be done, and who's going to do it? China has both the political will and the economic capacity to make a difference, but only if it acts in a decisive and thoughtful fashion. As we've heard in our discussion with Mark, decisive has its dark side in China. In the rush to make macro decisions, there have been economic and societal casualties. More thought is required this time around to ensure that the financial systems are in place to support, not destroy, the growth of clean tech innovation and the products and services that flow from it. In the environment, China faces its greatest challenge ever. As the world's biggest polluter, it has something to prove to itself
and to the world. If the emancipation of the Chinese economy these past two decades has been the dragon stirring, perhaps the promise of a clean tech revolution will signal its great awakening. So there it is. Thank you for listening. For more information and for links to Clifford's homepage and blog, visit us at www.insideasiapodcast.com. And until next week, this is Steve Stein saying, come in from the outside on Inside Asia.